We are Brightside.
Till like 6 o'clock, so a little after six, so about an hour and a half, is what we'll do,
and then God, we can never get it all done in an hour and a half. What are you thinking, man?
I know.
The last time we spoke for 6.5 hours.
I know. Yeah, but I don't think it all went out over the air.
No, I mean
the phone call. Yeah, that's
the phone
right.
Call was 6.5 hours. That was sick. So, I'm absolutely exhausted from last night because there's like I was up until about UK time, probably about 4:35 o'clock. Even though the advantage of the hour going forward in America and then also starting it an hour earlier did help, but didn't.
Yeah, it's funny you start out like that. That was what I was going to ask you is like, how does that work for you guys over there now? I honestly couldn't watch it. And here's, I mean, you actually stayed up and watched it. I couldn't stay up and watch the Oscars. We'll get to the conversation in a minute. You and I already had a quick conversation about it and I saw it and you'll know what I'm talking about. I saw it in the bar at the restaurant. My wife and I.
Okay.
We'll talk about it in a little bit. The opening monologue, right? So I literally didn't hear it. But I knew exactly what was going on. And that's when I texted you this morning and I was like, it pissed me off. And I was like, I knew exactly what was going on. So like I said, we'll talk about that later. But, like for you guys over there, what is that like? It's like,
traditionally it was a lot later. I mean, years ago, I mean, they used to start at 6 o'clock, Pacific time. Which was like 2 a.m. in the morning here.
Yeah.
So it used to go on till 5, nearly 6 o'clock sometimes. It's interesting, last night I didn't go, but they had the UK branch of the Academy had a dinner at the Dorchester, which a lot of my friends and colleagues were at last night. I noticed having a really good time at the Dorchester, which was like the official Academy UK dinner and live stream.
So if you were there, you wouldn't be here now. You'd still be recovering.
Yes. But, you know, it's actually better that it start, because it started at 11 o'clock here last night, which was, like, as I say, 3 hours earlier than it had in the past. I remember back in the, I think, when did Sky start doing it? Because it's like literally, in the UK, it was never broadcast live until Sky got the rights to it, which I think was in the late 90s. Up until then, the BBC used to do edited highlights the following night. So it was never quite. And when Sky got hold of it, they went to town and did a whole, you know, themed evening around it with, you know, Sky Movies having a whole load of Oscar winners on it and various stuff like that, and it was a good promotion for them. I mean, it really sort of works, but they never had a particularly good hosted program because the hosts were very good. Last night, ITV in the UK, which is like one of the biggest independent TV companies in the UK, if not the biggest, has acquired the rights to it, and they did a program with a UK host called Jonathan Ross, who is very famous here, but I don't think famous anywhere outside of the UK. And he used to do a film review program. He's a host. He's a celebrity. He's into cults and manga and comics and various other stuff. Yeah. And I thought he did a good job. I mean, the haters were out there already. I mean, the program had only been on 2 minutes and they're going, Jonathan Ross is presenting Hell on Earth on ITV in relation to the Oscar. I thought it's just started. Yeah, they just wanted to damn it. I mean, it's like all these things, like literally, unfortunately, Hollywood, no one likes Hollywood anymore because everyone thinks Hollywood is woke. Well, literally anything they do, they just want to damn. So literally the pre-Oscar program was damned. The Oscars were damned. It was like, I actually thought the whole thing was actually very good. There was a few, we'll get into it a minute, but the Jimmy Kimmel, he went off key a bit. He was actually quite good. He's quite good at improvising. I remember years ago being at the a BAFTA Awards, because the BAFTA Awards is never shown live. There was several theories about that, one of which is my very dear friend Hamish McAlpine, the film producer, live on air many years ago when Woody Allen was receiving an award, and this was live on television, shouted at the top of his voice, "Kiddie effer." I got escorted out of the building. But supposedly that's a reason why it's not broadcast live anymore. But I was at one year where Stephen Fry was presenting it, and it was interesting that the whole technical thing broke down. And Stephen Fry cannot go off piste. I mean, when he doesn't have a script, it was horrendous. The guy just froze on the stage and panicked, and I was like, I felt really sorry for him. Whereas, like, somebody who's a genuine improv comedian, can handle hecklers and everything, would have been able to pitch and roll with it rather than, the whole thing stopped for 10 minutes while they reset it. And he had to go and sit down and have a cold drink or whatever it was, and then restart it again. But the Oscars is something else. It's like, I mean, I've been to the actual ceremony twice, in LA. And I must admit, watching it on television is far more enjoyable than being there.
It is a lot of live events are like that. It's one thing to be there and to experience it, but once you have, it's like, all right, I'll go home and watch the rest of them from now on.
Well, I mean, you're seeing everything almost from a distance, because it's like literally, you're seeing all the people coming in, but you're not where the reporters are interviewing them, so you're not quite seeing them directly face to face. The seat you have is so far back. I needed a telescope to see what was going on where I was sitting. I mean, luckily they got monitors right at the back of the Dolby Theatre, so you actually can look on the wall and actually see. So you might as well, you're actually basically watching it on television while you're there. So you can actually see what's going on, what the presenter's doing.
Right.
Because you are so far away. And it's like, you get ushered in, ushered out. I mean, luckily, if you've got a ticket to the Governor's Ball, because not everybody who attends gets a ticket to the Governor's Ball, you rock up to the Governor's Ball and you have to find your seat, sit down, they serve you a meal, it's all very regimented. Yeah, then you go off to some post-Oscar party or Oscar parties, depending on what you've been invited to and depending on how popular you are. I mean, it's funny because, like, this year at the BAFTA Awards, a very good friend of mine, Denise Parkinson, who's like I call her the queen of the red carpet. She went to every post-BAFTA party. It was hysterical. I don't know how the woman does it. She's got so much energy. It's like, literally, she was at the Universal party. She was at the Warner Brothers party, which actually looked pretty dour. And it was the Universal one that actually looked the most dour. And everybody else is, and I literally, and she went to every single one of them. And it's,
I feel like that's what I would do. Like, if I ever won anything like that, you'd be like, you'd just be partying the rest of, like, now here's an example. I didn't win this, but when the Boston Bruins here won the Stanley Cup in 2011, it's like my favorite sport to play. It's my favorite sport. It's something I always wanted to see. And to have that experience and like have them win, I stayed up all night long. It was like 3-4 in the morning. I'm still watching all the, you know what I mean? And so like, can you imagine if I actually won something like that? It's like I watched a team win and I stayed up all night and I was just looking for people to party with because nobody cared about it as much as I did. So I could doing that.
When my friends won for their film The King's Speech years ago, I mean, literally, if you ask them, if you asked Gareth or any of the, who won, accepted the award for Best Picture, I think from the moment that name was announced, they have no memory as to what happened next.
Oh, yeah.
It's like literally, you're almost like you're in a complete whirlwind of like, pushed here, pushed there, photographed. Everyone's asking you for something. And it literally, yeah, you have to go to the ceremony again the next year just to remember what was going on. It's like some sort of like flashback type thing. It is a very intense, experience, particularly if you're a winner.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine.
Christopher Nolan was hysterical last night. The first question he gets asked in the press conference afterwards was by some woman he went to school with.
Yeah, that wasn't that awesome? He's like, I was not expecting that. And then she even mentioned like one of the teachers. And he's like, are you talking about such and such? And they went back and forth. And he's like, and then he apologized to her. He's like, sorry, back to the question. she mentioned it out of hand, right? Like, hey, went to school, grew up with you. But yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, it's interesting that, I mean, he was the favorite. And it's very weird because you can be the favorite and still not win. And you could see that actually, you could see the relief on his face when he won. Oh, it was quite interesting because it's like literally, if you go back a couple of years and was it Wakanda Forever? What's his name? The actor who unfortunately passed away.
Chadwick Boseman?
Chadwick Boseman, who's basically his widow was there and everybody was expecting he was going to win. And he didn't.
Yeah.
And it was basically the Welsh actor, Tony Hopkins. He wasn't even there. He was asleep in bed. He won. And it just shows that, you can never predict these things. That everyone's going to be the one that's going to win. And then literally, he wasn't the one that won. His widow didn't pick it up. So literally they'd even rearranged the order of the show. So it ended on his awards. Cause obviously they had a big close up of his widow's face. Oh. I mean, that was actually quite cruel. Cause it's like, she didn't win. I actually felt for her.
Yeah. Painful.
The best one though last night though was I can't think of his name now. It was the UK visual effects guy. He was nominated 3 times in the visual effects award. He didn't win at all.
He didn't win any. Yeah. Yeah,
it's like Godzilla won, and it's like literally he was nominated for Mission Impossible. I'm trying to think what the 3 were. It was 3 of it. It was Mission Impossible, Colin, something his name. And I just thought it was just like, I mean, this guy's like, look, he didn't spread the odds that he had. He didn't have a 1 in 5 chance of winning. He had a 1 in 2 chance of winning, and he still didn't win.
Right. Oh, well, it takes the one, and it's, Godzilla -1 won that one.
That has caused so much uproar. Because it's really? Like literally, well, I mean, the film only cost $12 million. And its visual effects were done for the visual effects budget on any of the films was probably, all the other films that were nominated, it was probably 5 times that, or 10 times, in some cases, 10 times of the budget of Godzilla -1. So it just shows that, hard work, innovation, and basically knowing what you're doing, could beat all these things. So, I mean, it's interesting because you're going to see in the next 18 months to 2 years, AI creeping in a lot more, and that's going to, in theory, bring down the cost of certainly visual effects.
Should. It should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if I was a visual effects person, I'd be very worried at the moment because it's like literally, other than the very top supervisors, all the artists, you've got no future.
It's not that they don't have a future. Like, so it just changes the landscape a little bit. Yeah. And
well, it's about retraining and doing something else.
Yeah. But my brother and both my sisters work for this company. I think I've told you in the past and that in marketing and everything. And my brother's in charge of like, he manages the entire digital stuff. Okay. And they actually for years, him and I were talking about this a couple months ago about AI and that they used to sub out to an entire, like there are companies that will go in and erase the backgrounds and stuff. right? Just so that they don't have to do it. So there'll be a company for that. And him and I were talking, we both use Adobe Photoshop, and he got the beta version about a month before I got it. And he calls me and he's like, this is amazing. It's the new Dolby, you know, Photoshop, and it's got the AI background eraser. And it's like, it's just so intuitive. It's so smart that it was on he used it on his Christmas card this year. And he's like, DJ, look at this. And it erased the background around his son's, like, so say you have somebody standing in front of something like me and you right now, right? And you have a wisp of hair, just a single strand of hair sticking off. In the past, you just crop that out and you just erase the background. This AI actually just goes right around it. It knows to do that, right?
Fine detail is always a problem in matting. So.
Right. So they would have companies that would do this. He goes, those companies? Done. He goes, but now all those artists get allocated elsewhere. They'll all have to do something else because that isn't a job that's needed anymore. Now you can it's just so easy to do. It's either the company will still do it for you, but all the people, all the manpower is now gone. So it just reallocates what these people can do, you know? And it's
one of the best demonstrations of rotoscoping matting in real time I've ever seen. Funny enough, is actually done by Facebook. Facebook have created this algorithm that's incredible, and the demo they do is a basketball game, and the software knows exactly what each one of the basketball players is, and you can isolate and track any one of the basketball players, and it'll do it in real time. And you can go, okay, remove such and such, and it will literally just create a mat for him and just completely remove him or do whatever.
Yeah.
That to me is phenomenal, because literally, yeah, we spend a lot of money getting rotoscoping done, mainly in the Asian continent. And to be quite honest, it's not very good. You spend so much time sending it back and forth and getting them to do it again, because literally the quality of the rotoscoping is not good. I remember years ago when we did the remastering of Fantasia. I mean, literally, because obviously we had to do a lot of dirt removal, and we had to have lots of rotoscope mats created to basically isolate certain elements to clean them up. Mm. And they were horrendous. Whereas, like, spent weeks going backwards and forwards, whereas now I could just press a button and do it in real time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But let's get back to the Oscars.
John, you and I got
sidetracked. Go figure.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just like, you know, I was, funny enough, before we got on speaking, I was having my dinner and I was watching The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, I watch it every night. That is my one calming thing. I go to bed every night, I put that on, and it's like, I need it. It just calms me down and I can fall asleep and get up and do all this again.
so many people I've spoken to, that is their go-to calming device.
Really?
So many people, certainly in the industry we're in, I mean, I was talking to Stacey Spears, the guy who did the Spears and Mansell test disc. And that was his go-to bedtime, falling asleep thing, was to watch
The Big Bang Theory. I had at one of my dealerships, the manager of the dealership's like, hey, he sees me walking through the showroom and he goes, hey, he goes, go talk to, I forget what the salesman's name is. And he goes, go talk to such as, he just started watching Big Bang Theory. And I was like, how do you remember that I love Big Bang Theory? But so this kid, he's a new salesman. I say new, he's been doing it for like a year or so. Young kid, probably like 24. And he's like, just found Big Bang Theory. And I'm like, what are you up to? And he's like, he's in season 3. And I'm like, oh, wait till you get to this part, this blah, 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 blah. And we start talking about it. He's like, oh, I love the show. So, yeah, it's pretty funny.
Well, I would love to meet Chuck Lorre at some point and basically ask him who they base Sheldon Cooper on. Because I reckon there's an awful lot of they used Oppenheimer a lot to base on.
Yes.
Sheldon Cooper. Because having met with a lot of the people who worked on Oppenheimer, particularly the costume design people, some of the background they were giving me on Oppenheimer was quite interesting, that he was an idiosyncratic character who had an awful lot of quirks and traits and rituals that he used to do.
Yeah.
And it is literally, and he also used to wear, if you watch Oppenheimer, he used to wear his lucky belt all the time, which if you look at Oppenheimer, Oppenheimer's got a very obvious belt. And that was a, an Indian tribe gave him that as a teenager, and he never took it off. He used to use it to light his matches for his pipe, or, you know.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, you and I, we've had the private conversation. I don't think we ever, because we didn't want to talk spoilers and stuff or whatever, but we've talked the Oppenheimer, Big Bang Theory, the, all of the, they're not coincidences, but we were joking. And like you just said, like how much of, there's so much crossover because I think both Nolan and Laurie both did their research. On obviously with Nolan doing actual Oppenheimer, but then all the other scientists as well that are in Oppenheimer, the historical, you know, characters. But then I knew, and you and I, like we take this seriously. I know a lot of people listen go, why are they talking Big Bang Theory? But it is so, what's scary is how factual Big Bang Theory is to all of this stuff. And it was, and it's all brought up in the show. They mention Oppenheimer by name multiple times in the show. Yeah. They talk about, you know, the Manhattan Project in the show, but they mention all the other, the Fermi labs and everything that it comes up later when Sheldon and Amy are going for their,
for the Nobel. Yeah.
The Nobel Prize. Yeah. It's like all of this stuff. It Sheldon playing the bongos. When I saw that the first time I saw Oppenheimer and the guy, it, that they referenced him. Who's playing the bongo? I forget who the scientist was, but they're like
Richard Feynman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was Feynman. And they're like, and how many times they mentioned Feynman in the show? But yeah, Feynman plays the bongos. I just saw that episode like the other day. And it's like, oh my God, Penny, Feynman plays the part. It's so funny.
If you remember, they get to Mexico in Feynman's van.
Yes, I know. I know.
it's interesting because I haven't worked with Nolan a few times. Nolan, not to be disrespectful because he's a lovely guy, Chris, is that he's very similar to Sheldon in lots of ways. He has a lots of rituals and idiosyncrasies. I think that's what makes him quite unique. He's very obsessive. He's you know, He likes to set schedules. He doesn't particularly like human contact, which is weird. That has developed because Spielberg gave him a massive hug last night. Maybe he reserves it. It's like sort of Penny giving Sheldon a big hug. You know, she's about one of the only few people allowed to do that.
My wife would just say, "You just described me." It's like, the fact that I have to watch Big Bang Theory every night, I have to do this. I have to do these certain things in order. I have schedules. I love a schedule. I love regiment, being regiment. It's like now, like with the house, for instance, now that I'm busy and I'm working, it relieves the stress because I love working. I just, I know I got to get up every morning at 5:30. I do my thing. I get up, I watch my Daredevil for as much time as I can before I got to get out of the house. Tomorrow morning, I've got like 45 minutes. I'm up at 5:30. I got to be out of the house by 6:15. And it's like, boom. So I love that stuff. It's like from my mind. And you know, what's funny is I think for somebody like myself, like, I'm 54 years old, so they didn't have like ADHD when I was a kid, but it's like my mind, the way it goes so fast and I'm always jumping and thinking of different things, that the idea of taking as much off my plate that I have to think about is calming to me. So schedules and regimen and jobs, I have to do this, right? And be like, okay, boom. I have a direction. And Nolan, Sheldon, people with that kind of, they're smarter than me. They're geniuses. I'm just an idiot with that kind of mind, but imagine the power they have. And that's what it is. You can see it in Nolan. I don't like people either. It's like, I don't like being in big crowds. I just leave me alone.
I think what it is that literally, ADHD has been around for years. It's only now that they've actually given it a name. Because if you look at certain geniuses throughout history, they all have ADHD traits. And it's like, well, yeah. And it's interesting because it's like I was with because my son has ADHD, and I was with somebody who used to know my mother and father, and their daughter is 20 and she's got ADHD, and she's at university at the moment. She said, it's really funny. She goes, I can't stand the neurotypicals. She goes, yeah, in my dorm at uni, it's like, yeah, the neurotypicals are horrendous. They just sit in their rooms all day playing computer games.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're completely, it's like the people with ADHD, they like to get, yeah, they like to do things rather than just, you know.
Right. It gives you a focus.
Yeah.
It gives you a focus.
I can relate to Sheldon because it's like, literally, I like working and working really hard and doing stuff. And it's like, somebody says, oh, you got to go on holiday. It's like, what the hell do you do? I don't want to go on holiday.
I don't either. I'm forcing myself to go places. Like, I'm like forcing myself to go to Axpona so that I can unwind. Cause I do see the benefits when I unwind from and then come back to it. But if it was up to me, I'd be like, just keep on working. I never want to stop. And that's not a good way to be either. It can be good at times. People call it a good work ethic. I just call it me. It's like, but it's, you know, but there is a benefit to you have to recharge.
I think going back to the Oscars, I think Nolan could see a connection with Oppenheimer and his obsessive behavior. He's being slightly outside the, you know, the norm. I think he could probably relate to him, which is probably, you know, why he did such a good job on the film. Cause he could see, you know,
I think he sees Oppenheimer, at least the way Nolan portrayed him. Let me be fair about that. I don't know Oppenheimer. We don't know Oppenheimer, but all I know is like, so the way they portrayed him, the way Nolan portrayed him in this movie is he is such an open-minded thinker. And I think Nolan is too. That's why his movies are just so out there. He loves to just bring in ideas. So when you look at Oppenheimer through that lens, through Nolan's lens, what you see is that he's so open-minded, but nobody wanted to acknowledge him. You know, the basis of that movie was the fact that like he was being literally railroaded for bringing everybody's opinions together, right? That was like the genesis of like when in that quote unquote war room scene. And it's for anybody listening, you think this is a spoiler. It isn't. It's all history. So just go see the movie. It's like, but anyways, but he was telling like, so he had people at Los Alamos telling him, oh, we shouldn't be doing this. So he would give that opinion. Oh, we should do this. So he would give that opinion. And what they did is because he was the spokesperson and he was open-minded and thinking like, I see what both sides are thinking. Just like him going to the communist meetings, but also going to these. He's so open-minded that everybody was like, they don't understand that.
You've got to listen to everything. You've got to listen to everybody's arguments, everybody's discussion. As soon as you close something down, you're not, you know. It's interesting though, because like years ago, I worked on a film called Fat Man and Little Boy that Roland Joffe directed, that a very lovely guy produced called Tony Garnett, which I got Paul Newman and, God, it's such a long time.
That is a long time ago. Paul Newman.
Yeah, Paul Newman played the Matt Damon character, because the film was about the character between the general and Oppenheimer. That's what the film was about, yeah. That relationship. And, I'm trying to think. The guy's got a famous sister as well, who's a good actor. God, go and see his face. John Cusack. John Cusack played Oppenheimer.
Oh wow.
Fat Man and Little Boy.
Yeah, no, it's an 89 by Roland Joffe. Yeah.
Yes, it's a long, long time ago. Wilmot Zsigmond shot it. It's amazing. It's amazing though. You watch that film, and unfortunately, it doesn't work. It's as dry as anything. And then you look at Nolan's interpretation of basically a much more expanded version of the same story.
Right,
and it flows. It's never boring.
Well, now this is Oscar stuff right here. It's the score. Let's be honest. Yeah. You and I have talked about this so many times. It is the, dare I say, the friggin' score. That movie cooks at 3 hours. You sit there and it's like, I started watching it today. And like right when I saw they won, I texted you, I put it on and I'm like, I'm watching and it's like, you just want to stay there and like time flies by and I'm like, crap, I got to get out of here. But it's that score. And that's what, you know, and it's amazing what the sound can do for the emotion, for the pacing, for everything. But it's that, in that score. And now, like, that won. So, I mean, it's
incredible. The score is incredible. It is an amazing, it's interesting because like Dune Part 2, I mean, I've seen that. Six, seven times, eight times now. I haven't seen it yet. and it's interesting that I don't think is going to go the same distance as Oppenheimer. Because it's still sold out in the IMAX cinemas it's in. But I don't think it's starting to drop off. Whereas Oppenheimer didn't actually drop off. It was just consistent.
Yeah.
Not to be a spoiler of... Dune Part 2, but I did think by the end of Part 2, it did actually turn into something like an episode of Dynasty. All these characters standing around and like suddenly, you know, I'm going to marry this other one. And it's like a woman scorned and it's like, oh, for God's sake, you know, she goes off and she's absolutely pissed. And it's like, I just saw Joan Collins and that lot. Yeah. similar sort of like thing. Yeah, you know, Christopher Walken sort of like standing there looking like, what's his name? Colby in Dynasty. Oppenheimer is a unique piece of cinema that I don't think Nolan would probably ever come close to it again. You never know. He might do, but it's like one of those things. He nailed it, basically. I mean,
it's, would you say it's the best movie he's ever made? I would.
I'd say it is, I'd say it is by a long shot. I mean, I was fortunate to work with him on Batman Begins and Interstellar, and it's like literally, they're both very good films, but they are nowhere near as engaging as Oppenheimer. I mean, Oppenheimer, it's 3 hours and 8 seconds. And it's like, I mean, that 8 seconds is important, by the way. That's the difference between good and genius.
Exactly.
but it's like, it never seems like 3 hours. It like literally, I can sit there and watch it and it like, it's like having a cup of coffee. It's like you sit there and it just goes down and you feel great afterwards. I mean, it's really unfortunate now because I've got it in the digital form and also on physical media. And it's like, literally, it's unfortunate because I like my obsessive compulsive behavior. I can watch the same bits over and over and over again.
Yeah. It's what's funny is it's like, I'm the same way. I can watch this movie over and over because what he did with Oppenheimer is that he took something, to your point, Fat Man and Little Boy, dry, boring. And now he took that and turned it into a creative piece of art that like he made like an Interstellar type thing, like so entertaining, but this is factual. This is like, or not factual. I mean, it's based on a true story, right? So. It's to be able to do that and have it to be as entertaining and also as difficult a piece to talk about too. I mean, I had listeners emailing me and texting me after this dropped and they were like, it's just such a depressing subject matter, right? Because you're like, we're talking about the invention of what could destroy us all. And it for him to take that and create this is really pretty amazing. It's, you know, it's, I mean, they, like you said, Fat Man and Little Boy, not very entertaining, same subject matter. And now it's an Academy Award winner that it's I mean, multiple levels here.
Well, I think it comes down to the attention to detail. Going back to the belt buckle thing. I mean, like it's like literally all the little details. And it's like, it's interesting. Anybody doing any research into it, if you look at enough pictures of Oppenheimer, you suddenly notice he's wearing this belt all the time. And the fact is that Nolan went to the trouble to get, yeah, it's like, yeah, he has to have that belt. Yeah, he has to have this from looking at footage and film, because obviously there's very little footage and films of him, but also then think he's like, yeah, his obsessive tics of using that belt for almost like a comfort blanket. Yeah, and that's the sort of depth that Cillian Murphy brought to the character that, you know, I think, you know, as good an actor as John Cusack is, and I must admit he's in probably the most disturbing horror film I've ever seen, Room 1403, which I think is a testament to Cusack's amazing acting ability. I mean, I'm not saying that Fat Man and Little Boy was because he's not a good actor, because 1403, I don't know if you've ever seen that.
No.
1403 is a horrendously disturbing horror film. It is the worst nightmare ever. Like, see, and Cusack carries that whole film for 2 hours. He's literally the only actor in it.
I'm looking it up right now. 1403.
Is it 1408? It's basically, if you,
1408.
1408, sorry, because you add all the numbers up and it comes to 13. 1408, sorry, 1408, because literally 13.
Samuel Jackson, so John Cusack, yep.
Yeah, because the guy who directed it's a Swedish director, and I worked with him on a film called Derailed. And it was, yeah, he'd done a previous horror film before, and then we did Derailed, which was a sort of thriller with Jennifer Aniston. And then he went off, and I must admit, I didn't particularly rate him because he seemed to spend most of his time on the phone when we were doing Derailed. And then he went off and he did this horror film, and then it's like something complete. It's like totally blew me away. It was like actually so disturbing. So anyway, yeah. So Cusack is an amazing actor. I just think it's the sum of all the parts. And Cillian Murphy was in a production there that had so much going for it. You know, everything was firing on all levels. I mean, you know, you got Hoyt Van Hoyt who shot it, who's, you know, gives it another level. He's a master of his craft. Literally, he's become, you know, he's a modern day Freddie Young, Freddie Francis, amazing films.
What do you think, like in the Best Picture acceptance speech, they mentioned IMAX, right? And it's like, I'm like, for us as home theater fans, I was like, oh boy, how much do you think that played in to the movie? Every single one of them, not just the movie itself, but the, you know, Robert Downey Jr., Cillian Murphy, everybody winning these Academy Awards because of Nolan's choice of how to shoot this movie and using IMAX the way they did. Obviously they got cinematography, not obviously, if you don't know yet, they got cinematography, right? Yeah. That adds to me, that adds into Cillian Murphy's performance, Robert Downey Jr.'s performance, Emily Blunt's, everybody's performance, especially when you see the extras on what they had to do, like that scene at the end, it's kind of like a gymnasium type makeshift. And they show you that, like, Cillian Murphy's at the podium. And obviously there's a wide shot, but the actual shot of his face that's in IMAX, the camera's like what? Like 5 inches off the end of his nose. And yes, he has to act that out with a camera, an IMAX camera that big, 5 inches away from his face or whatever it was, right? Those decisions to do it that way. How much do you think that played in to the, you know, winning all these Academy Awards?
Well, I think that's probably adds quite a lot to it. I mean, but that's the testament of a great actor, because a great actor can block out. I mean, you know, if you're on a set, you've got to get from A to B. So you're walking across something. There could be dolly track in the way. There could be cables in the way. I mean, in real life, that wouldn't be there. So as an actor, you're walking along trying to have a conversation. And also at the same time, you've got to avoid tripping over something.
Exactly.
yeah. And it's like, yeah, you've got a camera in front of it. And like, the concentration there, because literally that's the skill of being a great actor, is that you can block out the real world and somehow be living in this world of that you've created, that Oppenheimer's in, and you believe you're there. I mean, right. that's quite something. I mean, that's why he won. I mean, Cillian Murphy is an exceptional actor, and he nailed that part. Yeah, it's like going over to the Best Actress award to Emma Stone.
Yeah,
I mean, not to be crude, but she bared all for that film, and literally it paid off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hell of a performance. I mean, as an actress, she made herself incredibly vulnerable, because literally she is totally exposed and also totally naked in the film. So literally she's pushing herself to the limit. She's got nothing to hide behind. And yeah, she does an incredible job. She's brilliant. And I mean, yeah, yeah, her English accent is exceptional. She spent a long time learning to sound English, because as she pointed out, it's like Americans have a problem saying water, because they say water. I think that film Poor Things is an exceptional piece of cinema. I think that is also it's also made by guys who are completely eccentric. Yeah, he didn't win, but you know, his actress won, the costume won. It's interesting. It comes out on physical media the day this has been broadcast. This thing we're doing. So it's interesting, but it's not coming out on 4K. And everybody is now petitioning, saying, "What? Yeah, it won 4 Oscars. Why can't we have it in 4K?" Because I must admit, having seen it in 4K, it looks something else. It's exceptional. I think is it on 4K on the Kaleidoscope?
I'm not sure yet. Let's see.
I'd imagine it is, because it's.
Oh yeah, 4K HDR, Dolby Atmos. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks exceptional. I mean, I saw it at a screening. I went to a number of screenings of it, because the first time I saw it, it was like this. Because the first 20 minutes of the film, I thought, "What the hell is this?" And then suddenly, I started to realize what was going on. I thought, "This is actually an incredible piece of cinema." And the production design and the cinematography, Robbie Ryan, who shot it, I mean, he didn't win, but he did an exceptionally good job. And a bit like Hoyt Van Hoyt, yeah, it's all shot on film, and it's shot on various film stocks as well. It's not 70 mil, but it's shot on some 16, some 35. It's shot on Ektachrome, which, is an incredibly colorful film stock, which Kodak really don't make anymore. I mean, ultimately they should have shot it on Kodachrome, but you can't get Kodachrome now for love nor money. Because Kodachrome was this incredible film stock that they made in the 40s and 50s, and that went on until probably about 2010. I think it was probably the last time that you could probably use it. And it's a dye-based film stock, and the colors are so saturated, it's off the charts. Ektachrome is not quite Kodachrome, but it's getting close. And if you watch Poor Things, it's like the colors are amazing. And that's because literally it's shot on Ektachrome, or some of it shot on Ektachrome. Some of it's on 16 mil, some of it's black and white. Mm-hmm. It's a whole hybrid of different things.
And, similar to Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
Like what he did, what Nolan did, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Robbie Ryan is a very interesting cinematographer. I lost out to him on a job many, many, many years ago, but hey, you know, I'll let it go. Yeah. I went my way. He went his way.
I have that one in my queue, bought that today and on Kaleidoscape. And then the other one I bought today when I saw that it won was, The Zone of Interest. One for Best Sound.
Jonathan, who I've known for quite a few years, he's a bit like Christopher Nolan as well. He's a very, very shy guy, very shy. And he is a genius. Because why would a guy who can't speak German make a film in German? I mean, literally, he's directing actors that he can't even understand what they're saying. He's got to rely on somebody else to say, yes, they said the lines correctly. It's Zone of Interest is not, it's an insult to call it a movie or a film. It's neither. It's actually a piece of art. Because after I saw it, I said to Jonathan, I said, this is an ugly film about an ugly film with ugly people about an ugly subject. And he said to me, he said, John, that's probably the best criticism I've ever been given. That's incredible. Because it is. It's an ugly film because it's about an ugly event right. in history. But it's supposed to be like that. And they've made everything ugly. The opening shot, they've cranked up the sharpness on the picture. So it's got artifacts in it. So it's like, ew. It's like, why is this like brutal? And it's like, I sit there going, because the first 5 minutes I was watching this because they're all like swimming in a lake. And it's like, why do the reeds look like so like they've got like horrible like sharpening artifacts to it? And it's like, I suddenly realized that they've gone out of the way to make everything brutal because these are brutal people who've got no comprehension of humanity. And yeah, it's a piece of art. It is an incredibly powerful piece of art. And it's like when the first screen I went to it, they had the reception beforehand, because it's like, there's no way you can serve food and have a dinner reception after the film. It'd be almost insulting. So.
All right, everybody sit down to a meal.
Yeah. You've just watched a film about people who brutalized and murdered millions of people and you're sitting there having a chicken burger. The particular place where they were screening the film, just one of the greatness of like having screenings there in this particular venue is they have particularly delightful chicken burgers that they serve. I'm thinking what the other, it's like literally they have very nice food. But to serve a dinner reception after the, film probably would have been, funny if it's exactly the same screening venue that I saw the Holdovers, it's interesting. I'm glad that it's interesting that the Holdovers didn't win for best screenplay, because obviously it's been sued at the moment by the guy who wrote Wonka.
I didn't know that.
He's suing Alexander Payne for plagiarism. And literally the day before the Oscars, Variety and everybody were running all these stories, because obviously they obviously filed the suit to for maximum publicity the day before the Oscars. And there's all this thing going around, and it's like, and then I think literally at about 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, they released the documentation on all the points of plagiarism. And it's interesting because Alexander Payne actually admits it was inspired by a film in the 1930s, a French film he saw. So I don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to see. Simon, who wrote Wonka, has also written quite a few other films, is filed the suit against them for so it'd have been quite interesting if he actually won for a best original screenplay.
That would have been funny.
The Holdovers was, I mean, I thought it was an interesting film, but I didn't. To me, it's a Sunday afternoon film. You can see.
I haven't seen it yet. I was saving it for next December. Cause isn't it, it's like a Christmas theme movie, right?
It's a film about a school, and basically it's about the pupils who,
it's in Massachusetts. Filmed in Massachusetts.
Cinematography wise, it is beautiful because it's basically shot digitally, but they went out of their way to make it look like it's a film shot in the 1970s. And it looks just like a film from the 1970s, even though it was shot on an Arri Alexa. I like Alexander Payne. I think he makes interesting films. I mean, he's a nice guy. He's done some very good cinema. Nebraska, I thought, was one of the better ones he did, which is with Laura Dern's father. What's his name? Bruce Dern.
Yeah.
It's all in black and white. I'm trying to think what else. What was the other? There's Holdovers. There was
our best picture.
Yeah, best picture. Holdovers, Oppenheimer.
Barbie was up there.
Yeah, but. I mean, Barbie. I liked Barbie, but Barbie.
I love Barbie.
Fat Bob is a bit like, sort of like, I don't know, something sugary and sweet. It's great at the moment, but then afterwards you sort of, you know, there's not a lot there.
Yeah, it was, I think it's very poignant, the movie itself, but on repeat viewings, it's not, I mean, I like the movie. I've seen it a few times, but it's not something like Oppenheimer where I'm just going to keep revisiting it. But yeah, it's, I love, what did you think of their, like, they had the, what part of it was they, where they made the joke where it was, Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, she's sitting on the bench and it's suddenly cut to Ryan Gosling, it starts to Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah, that's how they opened. Yeah. But the bit that Ryan Gosling did with, what's her name from Oppenheimer?
Oh, you mean, cause I've got the, well, they announced that, cause obviously they've got an award coming in the future for stunts. And obviously the Fall Guy is coming out shortly, which has got, Ryan Gosling and, Emily Blunt.
Yeah. And they did the whole back and forth. And I love the line, like, yeah, you know why they call it like Barbenheimer or whatever? Like, because. Yeah. Why Barbie comes first. You've been riding on our coattails all along. But then her line to him, like, yeah, it's like, I don't know why they compared us, because clearly after tonight it's not a competition. Which I thought was great.
You have to remember that the Oscars is just pure marketing, and that was all set up to promote The Fall Guy.
Yes,
yeah. The premise of The Fall Guy is about a failed relationship between the two of them. She's a director and he's a stunt guy, and they have a one night stand, and literally they can't stand each other. And then they're working on a film, and then suddenly realize they actually quite like each other. And then suddenly a strange murder mystery gets involved, and it looks great fun. And then suddenly they by the end of the film they probably fall in love again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to that because I loved the show, and this is a fun take on it.
Well, it's weird because it's shot in Australia, and there's loads of jokes in it about Australian accents, because there's like the bit where he gets pulled over by a cop and Ryan Gosling is taking the piss out of the cop because he can't speak. He says, "What are you saying? I'm sorry. Can you repeat that again?"
What did you think? I don't think you and I have talked about this. What did Killers of the Flower Moon was up Killers for Best Picture? Didn't win. I was happy to see that. I would have been very disappointed.
I was interesting. I was having a conversation with somebody earlier because they're working with Leonardo DiCaprio's company, and it's interesting because I mean I heard this from Leonardo himself because he told the story. Literally, he was originally going to play the FBI agent in it.
Okay.
And he spent 2 weeks going through it and realizing that the part had got no depth whatsoever. So he goes, "I want to pay her husband." And it's like, yeah, but that's a tiny part. And he goes, yeah, but I'm going to go. And he went off and rewrote the script, and he completely changed the script because the book is about the birth of the FBI. That's what the book is about. It's not really about the tribe and the issues of the tribe. That just happens to be the catalyst for they went to Washington, petitioned part of the Senate, or several senators, and they basically, you know, Hoover got involved and sent a load of guys down because he thought it was an interesting case for them to investigate. And that's really what the book is about. And then suddenly Mr. DiCaprio decides he wants to be the husband in it, and actually suddenly he goes, well, actually the more interesting story is about how these people got screwed over and how this bloke is so evil that actually he pretends he loves her just to basically steal all his money because he's just a greedy bloke. And both him and De Niro are horrendous characters in that film. I mean, they are deplorable people. They are worse than, I mean, you know, worse than you could ever imagine. I mean, it makes some of the horrendous race things in the Deep South actually look, because they were just killing people left, right, and center. They were just, it's like.
Yeah. And the manipulation, everything, like you said, like they were doing with marrying just to get inside the family and blah, blah. I mean, it's horrible, horrible part of history. But yeah, it's like, I just didn't like, I don't know if you heard, I said it on the show before, but I'm like, what I didn't like, I mean, it's a movie you should see. Absolutely. But as far as a movie, like a piece of entertainment or art, I was just like, it's horrible, I think, because it's just so negative. And it's like everything you just said, it's like, I mean, I actually compared it to Schindler's List. And I was like, look, Schindler's List is about a horrible part of history. More horrible than Killers of the Flower Moon. Right,
but at least you know they're being horrible. They're not lying to your face. Where those people are actually lying to your face, saying, "Yeah, we've been really nice to you while sticking the knife in."
Right. Yeah, but I mean, yes, but I'm saying like death count, everything like that. But Schindler's List, it was portraying that part of history, but at the same time, it was showing you Oscar Schindler, how he did good, how he did, you know, and it you don't want to watch that movie over, but at the same time. You're like, at the end of it, you're like, wow, there is good in the world, even in a horrific event. And what I didn't like personally for me, Mr. Brightside, Killers of the Flower Moon showed you nothing positive. And it's like they glossed over to your point. Like if the book is literally about the FBI, the FBI people aren't even barely mentioned. You don't know those characters. The entire movie is just based on all of the horror. But they're not showing you how it got corrected, how people, you know, they're not getting in depth with the people that did that. And that to me is like, it leaves a bad taste in my mouth at the end of the movie. It's like, this is just a hit piece on something that it's so easy to show evil. It's evil. Yeah. No kidding. But show us how we overcame it. Show us how people overcame it. Show us the positive side. Cause you know, it's like, and that to me was just like that anybody can make evil and show evil. And it's do what like people think Oppenheimer was maybe evil or whatever. Do it in a creative way to show you a different perspective or give it depth to a point that makes people think and like Schindler's List or like Oppenheimer, something like that. And it's. That's what I didn't like about Killers of the Flower Moon. So I would have been really disappointed if that won Best Picture.
I mean, yeah. I saw the film three times. And it wasn't until about the third time that I actually started to enjoy it because I started to see what was going on. But going back to what I was saying, I think Leonardo basically doing a 180 on the character and then suddenly changing the whole inflection of the piece into something about the relationship between him and his wife and how, and that was the center of the whole thing and how he was screwing her over and basically even, you know, claiming that he was trying to solve her diabetes and actually was just poisoning her to death. I mean, he's an interesting story on one side, but as you said, it's like literally, you know, there is no real character arc. Literally, you know, the guy sells his uncle down the river just to basically, you know, get himself out of a longer jail term.
Well, his uncle's the evil one. I thought. Yeah. I thought he was worse. I thought.
Oh yeah, his uncle is worse. But
De Niro was
interesting.
But anyways.
So yeah. I mean, Scorsese is at a point these days where he can do virtually anything he wants. And I don't think anybody, I think one of the reasons that they made it with Apple is that Apple basically just said, yeah, deliver whatever you want, Martin. Yeah. Yeah?
And it's funny because Scorsese was one of those people that was knocking on Netflix 5-6 years ago and knocking on the streamers like that's not real cinema. And now it's like, oh, they'll give him whatever he wants. He's like, okay.
Well, there you go. Calling me Chris. I don't know. It's interesting. Netflix has done Netflix has suddenly realized that literally they've hit the ceiling in streaming and now suddenly Netflix has realized like all the studios, licensing's a good idea. So some of our great films that have, like, you know, nobody's ever seen, Well, sorry, nobody's ever really heard of it, other than the few people who watch it on Netflix. It's like, oh, we could license it to somebody else. I mean, yeah, some of the films they spent hundreds of millions of dollars on. And they've got really big stars. And it's like, well, yeah, other than a few that they've released on disc, I mean, there's a whole library that they could license out. I mean, suddenly everybody's wising up on physical media and licensing. It's like, well, actually, there'd be gold in them, their hills.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it's almost crazy that the naivety of people in the studios these days. I mean, the film industry is the only business where people have something that people want and actually they're not giving it them. No, you can't have it. Any other business, they'd be bending over backwards to make it happen. Yeah. Yeah. Whereas the film industry is like, nah, what? You want to spend some money? Nah, we don't like money.
Who's one of the biggest people in the business? Disney. And they've been doing that their entire history. That's where we have the Disney vault, right? Yeah. They create that demand because it's funny you say that, John. It's like one of the things about, this type of I'm trying to describe business, if you will. I know it is a business, but the widget, if you know that they create, it has a shelf life, right? Like we as collectors like to buy these things, put them on our shelves and look at them, but it's so dependent. But once it's done, why am I buying it again? Right? It's not like if I make milk, you need more milk next week and then more milk. So when you create a piece of art and people buy it, they're done. Now you got to make something else. Oh crap. And not only just make it, you have to create it out of nothing. So creating a demand and not giving it to the people exactly when they want it that's marketing because you're literally creating a demand, which can potentially drive the cost up. It makes people because if you just give them if they gave us everything we wanted when we had, they would like literally run out of stuff. Oh, like now what? Then we'd be like,
I do think it's completely the other way, though. I mean, literally, there are so many films that should be out there. I mean, so many films that people haven't seen for years. Oh, yeah. I mean, you got all the indies who are doing a really great job, like Kuna Lobra, Arrow, and everybody like that, and Shout, who are basically going through the libraries and finding films that people haven't seen for years, and going, God, I haven't seen that since the '80s. I mean, there's a film that Emilio Estevez made that I think is brilliant, which is like his version of Bonnie and Clyde or Badlands called Wisdom. It's got an incredible score by the guy who does all Tim Burton's music.
Wisdom. I don't think I might have seen that. That might be one that I go, oh yeah, when I watch it, I'll say, yeah, sorry.
I haven't seen it for years. I actually try to search it out and literally it was a film that I think it was like 84, 85 it was made. And because like, as far as I can figure out, Emilio Estevez made two films. I think he made, Wisdom, and then he followed it up with basically a strange, bizarre sort of like remake.
Free Jack.
Rear Window, which was basically called the Garbage Men or something, or him and his brother were in it.
No, Men at Work.
Men at Work, that's it, Men at Work.
Yeah, Men at Work.
Which was not very good, but Wisdom was with him and Demi Moore. And it's basically, it's more pertinent now than anything. It's literally, it's about when all the farms were going bust in the Midwest and then the banks were foreclosing and like screwing everybody over. And he suddenly goes around and he suddenly decides to go and rob banks, but he doesn't rob them for money. He goes and finds all the farm mortgage documents and burns them and destroys them.
Yes, I did see that. I just looked it up. I see the poster. I'm like, yeah, I remember this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, from 86. Yeah.
Yeah, 86, that's 86, yeah. And his, it's funny, Demi Moore's in it because she was his girlfriend at the time. So, yeah, there's a real spark between the two of them as well.
Yeah, and this was like a predecessor to Natural Born Killers, to... Yes. What was the other one that came out with Natural Born Killers? There was another one. I can't remember the name of it.
Back to Tenant?
Nope. There was another movie just like that where they had, not Natural Born Killers. this, who was in Nashville? It was, that was Woody Harrelson. And who was the female?
And the girl who was in the film I worked on, Cape Fear, called,
California.
I think. California.
California with, that was David Duchovny, I think. Was that it?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, like Wisdom was, yeah, that came quite a few years before that, I think. Those all came out in either late '80s, early '90s. And then, but there was that huge rush of all these, like, you know, serial killers or shooting sprees or people that.
well, this year, I mean, we've got a whole host of like, yeah, apocalyptic films, End of Civilization. Yeah,
everybody loves those.
You know, I mean, I'm not quite sure what's driving all that.
Oh, geez, what could it be, John?
What could it be? the Donald, who Jimmy Kimmel got a very good joke in at the end of it about Donald Trump. I thought that was quite funny.
Oh, did he? I didn't hear that one. I didn't catch that one.
Well, he claimed that Donald Trump had tweeted saying that he was a hopeless host and should be replaced by the guy who was giving out tequilas. I actually looked at Trump's Twitter account. I couldn't find a tweet about it. It was really quite funny, but yeah, he got a great laugh from the liberal filmmaker sitting in the audience.
Yeah, he had the and he had the quip to Nolan after he won. It's like, so Oppenheimer wins, Nolan doesn't speak at all. It's at the acceptance for Oppenheimer Best Picture. And they didn't even use their time. No. You know, like, you know how some people go over, and especially on Best Picture and the music plays, and I always get uncomfortable because I feel bad for those people. But like, so like the entire cast, and there's a bunch of the crew up there, but they're all up, and Nolan doesn't speak. The other two do, and the camera just holds there. And they're like, nobody else is going to talk. Jimmy Kimmel just made the joke. He just filled in and made the joke about it. He's like, and it's too bad there isn't a way for Christopher to text his family members to tell them the good news, because he doesn't use he doesn't have a phone. Yes. He doesn't email. He doesn't do any of that stuff. So that was pretty funny.
Well, I mean, I think because he'd won Best Director, he felt that he thought it was his wife's. Yeah, because his wife's term, Emma Thomas, to basically reign in the glory of like winning that film. And I mean, yeah, they've been a team for years. I mean, they met around the corner from me at UCL, University College London Film Society, where they actually made a short film there that was shown in the Cambridge Film Festival. It won at the Cambridge Film Festival. I mean, that was back in 96. So, I mean, yeah, they've it's a long journey. I mean, they've done exceptionally well. It was just announced today that supposedly Nolan's bonus for Oppenheimer is $76 million.
Jeez.
Not bad.
Must be nice. That's all right. Yeah, that'll do. He'll be able to pay a few bills with that.
Yes.
Wow. What was at the press afterwards? The second question, I just remember being floored by it and listening to him and talking about, like, I think they asked him what it's like to organize, be the director of something like this big and see it. Oh yeah, that's what it was. See it like come to fruition, kind of, right? And he said something like, you know, whenever you do something like this, he goes, you hope there's an audience for it, but you just have to do. What, you know, he just really sounded like a true artist to me. He's like, you just do what you feel is right and hope there's an audience for it. And then to be obviously he wins, you know, honored by your peers like he was last night is just like he said, he goes, it's amazing, you know?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's like, as I always say, it's like the annual prize giving. It's like being at school and you get a prize. I mean, even Jimmy Kimmel made that joke at the end. He said, right, all of those who haven't won, hang around for the end and we'll be handing out the silver Oscars.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What did you think? Now, a couple of bad lines by Jimmy Kimmel that we're going to start with the animation one. That one kind of irked me, and I'm pretty sure, like, from what I've seen, online. A lot of people aren't happy about that when they went for best anime, which I thought, what was it, Spider-Verse we wanted? The latest Spider-Verse movie. That didn't win.
The
Japanese movie. But his line, like, saying, like, oh, raise your hand if you let your kids vote for this one. I was just like, are you kidding me? That is ridiculous. And obviously, I didn't watch this live. I'm watching clips this morning to catch up. And when I heard that, I was like, are you kidding me? Give me a break. Like, because these are like real movies. They're like,
there is some truth to what he's saying. Cause like a lot of people do let other people vote for them, as in like other members of their family or the people they work with. Yeah. Their office. Yeah. There's because they're quite lazy. So, I mean, yeah, it was a joke that basically was a sort of a joke that would work well to an industry crowd, but anything outside of that, probably it was like, it just looks a bit bitchy.
To me, it's like you're diminishing one of the Academy Awards.
Yes.
Well, right. And that's horrible. You're the host of the Academy Awards and you're like, isn't really real. This is for the kids. No, it's horrible because especially how far animation has come and how, how important it is. And it's a piece, it's no more or less a piece of art than anything else that won last night.
Well, and to have your host
diminish it like that, like, oh, like who cares? Buddy, who cares? Your writers.
I think he was doing a slightly off the cuff joke.
Shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, it didn't work to a general audience. You're right, it diminishes the whole thing. I mean, you are right, it's slightly disrespectful, but I could see where he's coming from on that. But basically, it wouldn't land particularly very well because it's not respecting what's going on.
So, exactly. Like, now, you're the winner, right? The team that won, that gets up there to win for the best picture and animated feature, they're walking up. And the host just said, this isn't even real. And you're like, it's awful to me. It's so stupid. It's like, could you imagine doing the same thing for like, best supporting actor? Well, because he couldn't get a role as a lead. Here we go. Yeah. This is for the little people. No, you don't say that. It's like, because they're all important. It's like, it's so awful.
I mean, going back to the beginning, him trying to sort of like, him trying to goad, Robert Downey Jr. by making fun of his drug addiction was a bit, even Robert Downey Jr. Yeah. Cause he put his finger on his nose going, that's like too much on the nose, mate. Sorry.
Exactly. Exactly. And it was like, what are you doing? And that's why I told you earlier, like, that's the one where I didn't even hear that one. Like I saw it, I was watching it, but we had no volume in the bar and I'm watching it and I'm like, is he seriously going there? And you could see on Robert Downey Jr.'s face how, and he's like, I hated it. And then when I actually heard it, when I watched the replay and I heard it, I was like, come on, buddy. You got nothing better to say to somebody that could potentially be winning an Academy Award tonight? Come on.
Yeah, Robert Downey Jr. is a testament of somebody who's turned his life around from absolutely horrendous addiction. I mean, that's why his wife is never more than 5 feet away from him because literally Susan, his wife, has kept him on the straight and narrow for ever since she's been involved with him.
Yeah. Would you say, I think he's a testament, but I think he's also a product of the newer times, meaning, what he had to go, he either would have died. If it was 20 years earlier, he probably wouldn't have lived very long, right? He could have, and even 10 years earlier, think of like a Belushi, right? And think of the artists that died going through in my lifetime that I remember and heard of, and they came before me in the 60s into the 70s. You got Elvis, you got Belushi, you've got Janis Joplin, you've got Jimi Hendrix. All of these people led these lives and they were allowed to do it. It was behind the scenes. Their media coverage wasn't as great on their private lives, right? So they could get as messed up as they wanted. And Robert Downey Jr. is one of those people that he was coming into, it was pre-internet days. So he got a little bit of forgiveness there. Cause if he led that lifestyle today, he'd just be like, forget about it. He would have been destroyed, right? So, but there was enough pressure from people going, this ain't right, because people saw what happened to the people in the past, and he cleaned it up, and he did. And to his credit, he listened, and he, you know, obviously went to jail. He did all that, so he kind of got, you know, smacked in the face over it. But he cleaned his life up, and now, and I mean, here he is winning an Oscar. You know, I think he's a product of the times changing, and he's that one actor that actually shows the adaptation of how, like, because before that, like I listed, they were just allowed to run free, you know, watch, you know, what was the movie that came out with, you and I talked about it a while ago, last year, where they showed the movies, silent pictures and the, you know, Babylon,
yes.
Yeah. That looks like Robert Downey Jr.'s wheelhouse.
Yes.
Right?
I think. I mean, so Jimmy Kimmel sort of, like, that was a cheap gag that didn't really, and then he went on to some strange gag about, like, you know, is that your acceptance speech in your pocket, or is that a, I don't know.
Yeah. And then something about Tim Allen and a dog. You're like, he's swimming there. He's drowning. He's like, I need help. Anyways, let's go back to the fun stuff.
Yes.
This is another question I want. Well, one, you're an Academy member. You voted, right?
Yep.
So, and yeah, cause you said to me, one of the things you said to me this morning, I'm like, what'd you think? I said, what'd you think? And you're like, well, everybody I voted for won, so I'm happy. That's cool. You being an Academy member and a home theater fan, how many Academy members do you think actually have home theaters?
Well, a lot of directors I know have very good home theaters. Quite a lot of them are obsessive about it, but I'd say middling. Well, actually, saying that is like, you know, some directors I know, literally, you're lucky if you got a TV that works. I remember a lovely guy, Chris Mengus, who won 3 Academy Awards for cinematography. He lives in Wales, and his wife is absolutely obsessed with horses. So most of his, I think he only works on films so he can earn enough money to buy horses for her. I remember going around and, like, literally, because this is years ago, he wanted advice on a TV because he was watching everything on a 14-inch color portable. Yeah, this is a guy who's got 3 Academy Awards for cinematography.
Hey, if you know your stuff, you don't need to see it huge. You just know it's right.
I'd say that home cinema is becoming more. People are designing that. Back in the day, if you looked at it, the television was a feature of the room. I think now, literally, people are designing rooms that are home cinemas.
Yeah, they're more dedicated cinemas for these for people.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who's basically he's got a double garage. He's going to convert his double garage into a home cinema.
Oh, he's pulling a Steve George.
Yeah, well, there you go. Steve's trendsetter. You see, trendsetter.
There you go. Yeah, I was like, I don't need a car in there. I need my seats.
But yeah, I think so many people, I think, are going that. But the problem is with screeners for the Academy is that now almost a large amount of it is online. The American Academy still sends out a few physical discs. The British Academy doesn't send any out. It's all online. But I can't watch films online. I tried to watch Anatomy of a Fall online. I could not watch it. I actually fell asleep watching it. So I had to go to a screening. I had to go to a screening because you're at a screening. Yeah, it's why I go to a screening. It's like your phone's turned off. You're not doing email. The phone's not ringing. You can't pause it. So you have to pay attention and watch it. It's like a discipline.
Right.
Whereas I said, watching Anatomy of a Fall, I tried twice to watch it at home on streaming, and I fell asleep both times.
And it's not as, like, even that, like, I've talked to Steve, he get, you know, now and then he'll get screeners and stuff, and but it's, like, just crappy audio. You know, it's not done up right. It's just allowing you to see the movie, you know, before, yeah, at home instead of, it's not like a Blu-ray or a 4K disc or something. It's just, it's horrible quality.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, and also particularly the Academy ones, because you have to log in with your thing. Usually your name is in, or a name with a serial number is embossed across the screen somewhere, which is really irritating to look at. Suddenly it says John Thompson 7719 or whatever it is across the top of the screen. It's like, yeah, and it'll obviously appear and disappear, but it's just like, it's just really annoying because watching this, like, why is my name fading up at the top of the screen? I was saying to Steve the other day, it's like literally when I first joined years ago, like VHS was the thing, and it's like literally, they used to send out VHS tapes, and then they moved to DVD, and then obviously there was a little experiment with there's a thing called Dolby Creative, bought this company called Cinia, and they created the Cinia player, which was basically encrypted discs that would only play on a player with the right key. So Dolby sent all these discs, all these players out. Yeah, so everybody got a free player. And the whole thing collapsed. I think it was like a year in. Spielberg's film Munich, they did Spielberg's film Munich, and they sent it out to all the British members, or the British BAFTA members. And of course, the people who'd authored the disc in the States had authored them as Region 1 discs. So you put them in the UK Cinia players, and it just came up wrong region. So Spielberg was denied I think he went absolutely ballistic, and that was the end of Cinia. And then obviously they moved.
Cool figure.
Yeah. I remember getting an email going, you can keep the player. You do not have to return it, but if you wish to have it recycled, we'll come and collect it from you. And it was the cheapest, nastiest player ever. I mean, it must have cost them next to nothing. But I can't remember what player it was. It was like some cheap Chinese player where they'd basically put some custom firmware into it that would only play their discs.
Yeah, like DVX was like that.
DVX was similar. Yeah, it was a similar
same
to
idea.
DVX.
It was a one shot disc. Once it played, you couldn't play it again. So like it was like, but I'm like, what a giant waste of material. Like, you buy a disc and you rent the disc, you get it for cheaper. It's like, here you go. And you can only watch it once. Like, what? Well,
they were like $5.99 or something, $6.99. I remember because I've got quite a few.
It was like a rental you never had to return, but now you got this coaster.
Yeah, I think I've got four or five DivX discs I bought in the States just for the novelty factor of like, well, I'll keep these.
Yeah.
There'll be like some like objet d'art in the future to say, look, kids, this is what we had at one point.
Yeah. Talk about a waste of, like, if that took off, like, that wouldn't make it today. All of a sudden, like, where are these going? Landfill full of Blu-rays?
Yeah. Yeah, it would be the ultimate environmental disaster. It's like, you're just creating waste, e-waste.
Yeah. And you still have to press the movie. Into a disc, you know, you still have to create a disc, but now it only plays once. It's like,
so they had Cinia.
That doesn't make sense.
When Cinia failed, they went to doing encrypted discs. Watermark discs. And now this was hysterical because like each disc was costing about $300 each. So imagine you're sending this out to like 20,000 people, sending out to all the British members, all the American members. Yeah. You know, and it's costing $300, $350 a disc. Yeah, and they're FedExing them as well. So you've got the FedEx cost of, like, yeah, sending each one. So it must have cost them a fortune. And I mean, you put these discs in, it says this disc is uniquely watermarked for you. And yeah, again, it'd be a thing with, like, have some stupid, like, your name with some code after it, like, popping up on the screen every now and again. And then that obviously got superseded when obviously they got into streaming, because obviously streaming, you can do all this stuff at a lot less cost and you're not creating a lot of e-waste. I mean, the only problem is like when they send you these discs, they'll play forever. The only problem is with the streaming ones, if you go now, I mean, I think the streaming portal, they'll start to delete all the films now. So you won't be able to watch anything. Technically, I think it was like April, it said, please destroy this disc by cutting it in half by April, say, I don't know, 2020. The evolution, I remember by back in the day though, because I remember was it the first Harry Potter film? I think it was the first Harry Potter film. The VHS tape they sent out for that was incredible. It came in this beautiful cardboard sort of chest, and it was like presented in, it's like this box turned up that was like the size of like a sort of, yeah, a large amplifier. And then you open it up, and what the hell is in here? And there's this box inside a box, and then there was this like beautiful chest, and inside this chest was this like VHS tape of Harry Potter. I thought, well, you've got 10 out of 10 for, presentation. But I prefer to go to screenings. Two reasons I like to go to screenings. One, I like to go out to the cinema. And secondly, if you're lucky, they feed you. As I said, the chicken burgers are particularly good at the Hanyard Hotel.
It all comes back to the chicken burgers for you.
Yeah. You haven't tried these chicken burgers. You come over here. I'll have to, because it's like... They must make the mayo themselves, because the mayo is exceptional.
I don't like mayonnaise.
Oh, okay. Well, you'd have to have one without the mayonnaise.
Exactly. I'll have to get the one without the mayonnaise. But, yeah, that's hysterical. The chicken burger. Chicken burgers.
Me and my friends, because, like, it depends. It's like, usually it's like waiter service. So me and my friends have got it usually sussed out as, like, if you stand at the far end by the doors where the waiters come out, then you basically get, you know, served first. I usually go, oh, look, you've only got two left on your tray. Let me help you out with that one so you can go back and get a fresh tray.
Only you. We'd be like, hey, let's do some Oscar talk. Oh, we got to talk about the food you get when you go on these things.
We're not shallow people.
Nope. It's all right there, right up front. Oh, that's great. That's great.
Well, the weird thing was I got really annoyed because literally they brought in a new law. Not a new law, sorry, I suppose it's a rule or whatever it is for voting, that there was no hospitality allowed for third round films.
What?
So literally, like, first and second round, they could wine and dine you till you passed out. Third round films, all you're entitled to is a glass of water.
What do the rounds mean?
Well, like, you have first round voting, second round voting. So literally you have all the films, like every film that's eligible. Just to break a little thing, you have to pay to be eligible. So right. It's like $30,000 per film. So you pay the Academy $30,000. So you pay the Academy $30,000 and your film will be on the ballot. So you'll be on the ballot.
Okay.
So literally, I don't know, the first round ballot could have 310 films on it. I mean, nobody in there will ever see all 310 films. It's almost impossible. Right. Another guy runs IMDb, Colin Needham. It's almost like his mission. I think this year there was like 310 films. I think he saw 280 of the 310. So it was like his mission to see all the films on the ballot.
Wow. So there's that many, and that's the first round. How many does that get knocked down to?
And that gets knocked down to the second round. So I think there's probably, I think in all the categories other than Best Picture, I think there's probably 20, I think I can't remember, there's 20 films, 20 films in each category it gets knocked down to.
Oh, wow. And then, like 300 to 20?
Yeah, in each category. Oh,
wow. So the top and 20 vote getters get the second round.
And then from the second round, it goes down to five, or in the case
of. And that's what you end up with the nominations.
Yeah. And then the third round is the final one where you vote either on, you know, for the five in each category. In the first round, though, you only vote on Best Picture, Actor and Actress. The committees whittle down for like sound and cinematography and visual effects. It's only in the third round that you vote on everything.
Okay. Third round is the nominations you get. Yeah. And you're voting. Okay. When does all this start? At the beginning? Like,
well, I have a strange feeling that in the next couple of weeks, there'll probably be like some film and they'll like start, they'll do a for your consideration screening of it. Cause like last year, I think it was about April or May time when the first film, cause I mean, if you've got a big film, yeah, you want to get in early. So, but I mean, the main thing, cause literally, the way it works is you have Sundance, South by Southwest, Cannes, Venice and Toronto, and then really the award season kicks off then, because literally all the films will be announced amongst those festivals, and literally Cannes will be the big one where most of the films will get either screenings or announced, and then if not, you know, Venice and Toronto will be the next big festival where they'll get shown, like, for example, like the Joker premiere at Venice. I don't know where this year it's going to premiere, because it might be someone, you know, they might do it at Venice again to try and, you know, follow their luck. Then there'll be a big onslaught, from about October onwards. The main thing, certainly in the UK, that it all stems around is the London Film Festival, because the London Film Festival, even though there's an awful lot of money in marketing, there's economy of scale. So what they do is that the London Film Festival's on. So when all the talent's in town, what they do is organize ancillary screenings to the ones in the London Film Festival with all the talent that's come to the London Film Festival for awards as well. So they always like, they can get double bang for their buck. So like Killers of the Flower Moon was showing in the London Film Festival. But then also they had a load of ancillary screenings during the London Film Festival for Academy members at the same time. And I hate going to screenings at the London Film Festival, because it's in the Royal Festival Hall, which is the worst place to watch a film. You have to go watch it again somewhere else to actually understand what they said in the dialogue, because the sound is so horrible in there. It's like, what did they say? Yeah, it's not, and then the seats are uncomfortable as well. So, you know, go back to my favorite, the Ham Yard Hotel is very nice. Catering is good.
There we go.
It's beautiful, the Ham Yard Hotel. It's got full Dolby Atmos. Maestro. I saw Maestro there the first time, and the second time when Bradley Cooper turned up with Steve, what's his name, who did the sound on it. That was at the Soho Hotel, which is also, it's owned by the same company, the Ferndale Hotel Group. They must make a fortune out of award screening, because literally during award season, there's like two or three screenings at their properties every night. And they charge, I mean, they're talking about $3,000-$4,000 a screening minimum. Yeah. So if you put your food on top of it, you're easily looking at $20,000-$25,000. You know, for one screening.
Wow.
So, the best thing for Academy members is that the magazine Deadline in October does this thing called the Contenders event, which is an all day event on a Saturday. And they wine and dine you like it's going out of fashion. I call it like speed dating for awards. So literally, obviously each film has to pay to be up there, but literally what they'll do, they'll have like 15 minutes to pitch their film. They don't show the film. They just might show a clip or a trailer, and they have 15 minutes to pitch it to the audience as to why you should vote for their film.
Wow.
It was like funny because this year, because it was hysterical, because it was like, it started at 8, I got there at 7:30. It started at 8 o'clock in the morning. The first session was at 9, which I think was Saltburn. Emerald Fresnel came on and was very good and very interesting. And then this next session was Ridley Scott, who I don't think quite understood why he's supposed to have been there and why he was there at like 9:30 on a Saturday morning. Basically got into a massive argument in the host who was interviewing him, who made the fatal mistake of comparing him to Stanley Kubrick. And then basically Ridley then gave this guy a stripping down and a lecture on the history of Napoleon. And then asked anybody in the audience if they'd seen the film. And, of course, nobody had seen it. But one guy at the back said, yeah, I've seen it. And Ridley said, don't worry, the police will be around to see you in a minute. So that was hysterical. But, I mean, that's really interesting because literally that's, you know, quite an interesting day. And, I mean, literally they wheel out. I mean, I think, was it this? Yeah, I think, no, it wasn't. Yeah, no. Barbie, Greta Gerwig didn't come along to this one, I don't think. It was like all the technical people from Barbie. And then I'm trying to think who else, but a lot of the actors and actresses turn up. Obviously the problem they had this year is that most of the talent couldn't turn up because of the actors' strike. So that really sort of stymied a lot of these things up until, you know, the actors came off on strike.
That's right. Forgot about that.
I mean, that was a real downer for the award season this year, because it's like, you know, a lot of the reasons a lot of people like going to the award screenings is you get to meet the talent. Now, particularly if they have a mixer. A mixer's really good because you can stand there, you know, making small talk with Ryan Gosling while drinking a cocktail. And obviously this year that didn't really happen.
Do you think that could potentially, that's the reason that like Margot Robbie, she wasn't even nominated. And do you think that, like, that pitching?
Possibly, yeah. Possibly, you know what I mean? Might have had some effect, yeah. Because the personal touch does seem to help. It's like, literally, from my experience, if you want an Academy Award, you have to go out and sell yourself. You really have to push it. I mean, it was interesting because Nolan, I don't think he did a single appearance in the UK for the film, which was a bit disappointing. But in America, in Los Angeles, he was working it, baby. He was working it. Yeah.
Well, you went to the one you texted and called me like right at, it was funny because of our time difference. You had literally just walked out of a screening. I was just getting up in the morning, but it was the Nolan one with the actual, with his print, right?
Oh, yes. That was on a Saturday morning.
Exactly.
I'd been to see it because I knew the woman who was doing the awards campaign for her, Tolly. She's lovely. It was basically organizing the Academy award screening.
That was in the fall. That was like a while. Yeah. That was a while ago.
I'd been to see it at the BFI IMAX. And the print they had there it was a horrible print. It got fogging in one place as well. When he's talking to Dr. Robbie and Dr. Robbie wants to leave the project, there was like orange sort of like flames going across the screen. I thought, if you've never seen it anywhere else, you'd probably think this is part of the film, maybe.
Right.
And I said to Tolly, I said, yeah, if you're going to do an Academy screening for this, you've got to get a decent print of it. And she said, oh, don't worry, I'm on it. So she then contacted me and said, don't worry, I've got Chris's personal print that's going over to the BFI IMAX. I went and saw it. And I have to say that the difference between the first print they had at the BFI IMAX and Nolan's, like, one of his reference prints was night and day. It was like, you know.
Yeah, you were blown away.
Stunning. It was like watching a different, well, it wasn't a different film, but it was like watching the experience was something that, you know, It was like going to see somebody live, playing live. It was like going to see Tina Turner play live or something. You know, it's something you won't forget. And it was quite something. I was absolutely blown away by that. That's because the Tolly who was organizing, I had a go. Well, I didn't have a go at it. I said, if you're going to do this, you want to get a decent print. If you want to get, you know, if you're going to get all these people, because, yeah, it was like 9:30 on a Saturday morning, and literally it was absolutely packed. You know, I was very impressed. It was like literally, yeah, everybody and his brother was there. It was like the who's who of the British industry. It was good. A lot of these things, it's like literally, it's like Maestro, for example. Maestro, the last time I saw Maestro was with Steve, and I can't think of his other name, who's the sound guy from Maestro. And Bradley turned up, and they had EQ'd the hell out of the auditorium because the sound was, it's like literally, I actually said to them, I said, you've got to release this film Maestro on physical media because it's like, it needs to be, because you try and play it on Netflix.
Stephen Morrow,
that's it. Lovely guy, yep. Lovely guy. And the sound, you know, on Netflix is like, it's okay, but it's nothing special. You know, a full Dolby Atmos print of this in a cinema with a EQ, Steve had obviously made sure the sound was EQ'd properly in the auditorium. It was incredible. It was, I mean, the cathedral sequence where he's conducting the orchestra, which is, you know, that's Bradley conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. I mean, he learned how to conduct. I mean, you've got to give the man credit.
Yeah.
That he went to the nth degree on that. It was incredible. It's like the being at a real classical concert. And I think that really made a huge difference. And it's like all these things, you want to present it properly. I mean, I remember, they had us years ago when they did, Star is Born. They did the first ever screening of that, and he and, Lady Gaga turned up. And yet again, the sound was exceptional. It was like being at a gig. And it's like, it's like, that's how Bradley wanted it to sound. It's like you're at a gig. That opening sequence where he's playing the guitar and it's just like literally, you know, and the guy's kicking the bass drum and it's like, Jesus, the room is rocking. Which really works well because then it goes to the next scene where he's got tinnitus. And it does work quite well. It is quite a clever scene. That's the one thing about going to a screen, organized screens, particularly if the talent is turning up, particularly if the director's going to be there and, you know, the sound guy, is they make sure that everything is set up perfectly. The picture is calibrated perfectly. The sound is EQ'd exactly on spec. It's actually really good. You are not seeing it as the director intended. You're seeing it with the director and he's approving it while you're watching it.
That's something that how much does that affect you when you're voting? Do you make your opinions, like you as a voter, for instance, like, there's nothing, I mean, I don't think you are getting swayed off of Oppenheimer this year, but that's a unique year, in my opinion. Yeah. Just to take that one for example. Other years where it's close, do you actually listen and it's like, does that mean something? Like, are you like,
when you're voting in all the other categories in the final round and you're voting for sound or cinematography or editing, Oppenheimer, go back. I spent quite some time talking to Jennifer, the editor of Oppenheimer, because she turned up. I mean, she won last night. I mean, she's lovely. I mean, we had a long conversation about the glove.
Oh.
The glove in Oppenheimer.
What about it?
Well, when,
do tell.
Well, when, what's her name? Florence Pugh's character's committing suicide. Yeah. If you look at the top of the frame, there is a black glove.
I saw it on the first viewing. I couldn't believe people. You were one of them, right? You and I talked, and you didn't see it the first time. That's right. I'm like, multiple people I talked to said that, and I just remembered you were one of them. But yes, yeah. I saw that on the first viewing, and I was like, you know, he's putting that out there. Nolan's putting that out there that it wasn't a suicide. It was what's going on there. And yeah, that was one of you and I's conversation. You hadn't seen that. Now, did you see it before you talked to her, or did you talk to her and then happened?
I saw it. I think I saw it the second time. And then at the screening that she was at, it was like, you know, Probably by the time I'd seen it, that screening, I was looking at all the detail, which is why, because she was with the woman who designed the costumes, is why I asked the woman who designed the costumes about the belt. Because it was like so, it was like, having seen it so many times, it's like literally this belt is like staring out from you in every shot. It's almost like literally, you know, it's like a belt power. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. And I had to ask her about it. Like literally she then basically told me the whole history of all the research they'd done on this belt. That's the interesting thing. It's like, a lot of people don't appreciate how much research goes into making a lot of these films.
Oh, especially something like Oppenheimer, which is trying to be factually based, right? It's attempting to give you, you know, as many of the facts and be real to the source as they can. But what did Jennifer say about the glove in that editing process?
Well, she said they wanted to do it very subtly. It was very subtle, but it was a distinct conscious decision by Nolan to make a statement that he believed that she had basically been assassinated. But he didn't want to do it so blatantly, obviously. He just wanted to do it subtly that if you noticed it, you noticed it. If you didn't, you'd think she's committed suicide. So it's up to the viewer how their mind will perceive it. And it's interesting, as you said, I didn't see it the first time.
It's wicked subtle. But the idea leading up to it, too, is you had the people watching Oppenheimer in the lobby. You had people following him. But as a viewer, you're like, are they just following him, keeping tabs on him, or are they? And it's left ambiguous. Like, you know, yes, they threw the glove in there, but we all know this is a movie interpreting history. So who knows? And you and I had that conversation. Like, clearly Nolan believes, you know, that's why they purposely put the glove in there, because he thinks like, yeah, I don't think it's a coincidence that she killed herself, you know.
Well, I mean, Jennifer's like almost become the queen of large format, because the Darren Aronofsky film that's playing at the Sphere in Las Vegas, the 18K Sphere, she edited that. So she's obviously like she's Miss Large Format. I mean, that Sphere has to be seen to be believed. I mean, it's like that is the next generation that's IMAX on super steroids.
Yeah, I don't even know if that's a generation. You know, that's kind of like saying all amusement parks are going to end up like Disney World.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of like a once in a global thing. Kind of, you know, like we don't have pyramids popping up all over the world.
Well, it's interesting. They're trying to build one in London, in Stratford, where the Olympics were. And supposedly they're failing to get planning permission because the residents are saying it's going to be too distracting lighting up night sky.
You think? How'd you like to be the neighbor? Like, ah, crap.
Well, I don't know. Just give everybody blackout blinds.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to save on your electric bill because you're not going to need lights at night anymore.
So the good thing, I mean, the diligent voter, I mean, it's funny because the Academy sent out every year, like how to vote in case just you don't know how to vote, basically. Jesus. How to be the diligent voter. But I like to think I'm a diligent voter. I like going to the screenings where there's the Q&A and you meet the talent, you meet the technical people, you meet the, you know, everybody involved behind it.
So let me ask you this, because I gotta wrap up. You're in bed. Literally.
I'm still recovering from last night.
I know you are, but it's like, just to give everybody a glimpse that you texted me and you're like, is this just video, audio, or video? And I'm like, just the audio. And you're like, because the first time you're ever on, you were like all done up. You had the hat for Indiana Jones. You had the Barbenheimer shirt on. And I was like, oh, it's audio only. You're like, oh, damn. But this time you're like, you're prepared and you're literally laying down in bed, which I totally appreciate.
I'm when in Rome, do as the Romans do. I'm reclining.
But I do have one last question, but one other reference to the 24-hour podcast. You, 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 you were one of the few people in the quote room watching Brett end up like that. When he was at the end of the 24 hours.
I don't know how you did that. That was quite something to watch you do that for 24 hours. That was quite impressive.
It was fun. And we're doing it again. But the last question is, have you ever had an opinion on a movie and then changed your opinion on your voting because of what somebody said? Meaning like now you had a better explanation of something that went into a movie or an actor or, you know, a role that you were like, oh, I see what they're doing there. And it gave you a better appreciation for it. Did it actually help change your vote?
I'd say that like most people, you're open-minded right to the point where actually you click on, you know, what you're going to vote on. it's all online now voting. So you go online and you order your votes and you put them on your, what you're voting for. And I don't know. It's like, you probably do change your mind on certain things. I mean, Oppenheimer, I mean, it's like, if it's like there's really two really strong, I mean, like this year, Poor Things, I thought was a very good second to Oppenheimer because I really enjoyed it. But I saw Poor Things 3 times, whereas I saw Oppenheimer like a gazillion times. I mean, I lost count of how many times I've seen
exactly.
it. and I watch it again. Whereas Poor Things, I mean, I would like to view it in 4K in HDR on a nice disc. If anybody's listening, particularly in Sony. If they want to email, I'll tell them the catalog number of what the vault number of the master is. They can go and pull it out. it's the old saying about the film industry. My indecision is final.
Exactly. There you go.
This year, Oppenheimer was such an event that it's like literally, you know, no one was really coming close. Poor Things was, I mean, Emma Stone's performance, which was, she was recognized for her performance because it was something. Yeah, that was that was everything. It was mentally acting, physically acting, emotionally, it was everything. She's firing on all cylinders and she was using, you know, a full gamut of her body to, you know, the fact she can't walk properly to start with. And it's quite difficult to do, particularly repeating take after take, sort of like, you know, being dysfunctional in that manner. And she won because she's an artist. I mean, not many actors really are at that level. I mean, you know, Cillian Murphy is, Robert Downey Jr. is, you know.
Yeah.
Tropic of Thunder being one of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, his range is amazing, right?
Well, Chaplin, he's pretty. Chaplin,
I know.
Back in the day when he really had problems, because I worked on Chaplin briefly. I mean, he had real problems in Chaplin, because that's when he was going through the height of his issues.
Metamorphosis.
Yes. Waking up.
He was nominated for that too.
Yes.
And he didn't win, obviously, because he won his first last night. But
yeah. I didn't realize that. I mean, going back to Robert Downey Jr., his father was a very famous independent filmmaker, and you know, Downey Jr. was you know, his father was called Robert Downey because that's why he's called Robert Downey Jr. But yeah. he appeared in his father's film when he was like 2 or 3 or whatever it was. It's like, I mean, he was making quite interesting indie films that were quite sort of, you know, controversial for the day. Interesting topics. Which he sort of alluded to in his speech last night. He said, "I'm a product of my." Was it my? He said something.
Yeah.
I thought it was a nod towards his father because I saw the documentary about his father because I thought the documentary about his father was actually the problem I had with it is it wasn't a good documentary. It was too personal. It was like it would have been to me. It was like literally it would have been great for Downey and his family, but to show it to everybody else, I just thought it was a little too, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's what he said. I heard him talk on Rogan. Robert Downey Jr. was on Joe Rogan last year at some point. I heard that, and he talked about it there, about the documentary and stuff. But last night, his comment was like, I'm a product of my bad upbringing, and yeah. It was...
Well, his father used to sit there supposedly habitually smoking weed, and he was not a great influence. You can see where he probably got his drug problem from. I think he had his first joint when he was 10 or 12 or something. So it was like...
But that goes back to what I was saying before. It's like when he was being raised, these things were accepted. His father was coming from a time that things were being accepted willy-nilly. Go back to Babylon, and you're like, they just did whatever and nobody cared. And now he was raised at that time. He came, you know, his adulthood was the beginning of people going, wait a minute, this isn't cool. And he ends up in jail for what 20 years earlier was just being celebrated. And I mean, we're seeing that it goes throughout history. Times change and people have to adapt to it. And we're going through it now. We went through it then. It's not, nothing's new, but yeah, it's, you know, it was accepted when his father was his age at that time. And then when he gets older and he's in the world, it's not accepted and he's in jail and has to deal with it. And you know, it's crazy.
Yeah. I think his performance though in Oppenheimer is exceptional. I mean, he nails that.
Oh,
duplicitous senator down to the nth degree.
Oh, yeah. And especially like you can never go back and see it for the first time again, but I just remember seeing it for the first time and your emotions, how they change for him. And now watching it again, I want to actually take and make a clip of that opening scene with Albert Einstein and then the closing scene. So you get, you know what I mean? So you, at the end, you know that conversation and you, but at the beginning, you see his reaction to watching the conversation. You know what I mean? So just to see that and but his watching his portrayal of trying to be that snarky. Oh, like, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. But he's been manipulated. It's awesome. Awesome.
What I love about the thing at the end with Downey Jr., though, at the end of that film, is the hooks to other conspiracies, which is brilliant. He says, "Oh, so who voted against us?" And he said, "Oh, it's this new senator, new guy from I can't remember where he was representing now." Says, "Yeah, who's that? Oh, somebody called John F. Kennedy Jr."
Yeah, a young guy, John F. Kennedy. He wasn't a senator or something out of Massachusetts.
Yeah, Massachusetts. That was it. Massachusetts. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Kennedys are from around here. Yeah, from Massachusetts. So, Hyannis. And
I think Kennedy's an interesting one. I mean, I think he was probably. I don't know. It's coming back to a conversation I had earlier because I was talk about where my mind's going all over the place here. I was having a conversation earlier with somebody about Nightmare on Elm Street, and I was saying when I met Wes Craven, because I was in Sony Pictures in Studio City, and I was signing in. And I went, "Hey, look, I'm signing in just after Wes Craven." And he goes, "Yeah, man, I'm standing behind you." So I struck up this conversation with Wes Craven, and we ended up going for a coffee the couple of days later. And I said, "I've got a theory. Where did you get the title for Nightmare on Elm Street from?" And he said, "He said, go on, where do you think it's from then?" I said, "It's the headline of the New York Times the day after Kennedy was shot, isn't it? Because it said the headline of the thing says A Nightmare on Elm Street." He said, "You've got it." He said, "To me, my film, Nightmare on Elm Street, is about the death of American innocence. And that was the day American innocence died."
Wow.
The dream died and we're going to kill you in your dreams.
Oh, so, that's crazy. Well, I didn't know that. I hadn't heard that. That's awesome.
I mean, it's like, because for years I thought, why call it A Nightmare on Elm Street? And it's like, and then suddenly I remember watching JFK, and then suddenly the flashes up the thing, and it says A Nightmare on Elm Street.
They show the street. I just watched JFK, obviously, because it just came out in 4K and all that, but watching that movie today again, Oh,
yeah. It's like, that's another masterpiece. But it's interesting. That was the headline on the New York Times the day after Kennedy was killed. It said, A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah. That's crazy. I never put that together. That's awesome. Yeah, you did. And sent it to Wes Craven.
But I thought what was even more thing is like, yeah, it's the death. That was the death of American innocence. That's the day American innocence died.
It really was. A lot got exposed. A lot of, I mean, didn't the term conspiracy theory come out of that entire thing? Like that, well, there was that no was, such
thing. Yeah, it was, well, it was a thing, a discreditation technique designed by the CIA to basically diminish any argument against the correct narrative.
But they had been using it for years before that. Even before the CIA, what was the movie I just saw recently where it was like, it was Matt Damon. The movie about the birth of the CIA, kind of. What the heck? It's an older movie. Anyways, but oh my God, John, so many tangents here. That's a great one to end on though. That the Wes Craven story. That's awesome. That's fantastic.
I just remember him standing behind me. I was quite like, okay.
You got a jump scare out of Wes Craven. That's awesome. Oh man. John, you know, like you opened the show saying last time we talked was like, or we talked 6 hours. That was a great day of work for me, by the way. That was so much fun. I just had you in my ear for 6 hours. My battery was dead, but that was a fun day.
Well, I think we were both working at the same time. I was doing what I was doing. You were doing what you were doing.
Like, yeah, and we just kept going. It started early in the morning, and it was I was going to say it was a home theater related thing, but I don't want to go down.
We're talking about Kaleidoscape. That's where it started.
I know, but we were talking about, but it was so much more. And if we go down that road, I'm going to get stuff done.
Well, we've been talking for over 2 hours now, so I think it's time we call it a day. Because
yes. Know, you gotta get to bed.
The most devoted listeners will be giving up at this point.
Yeah, you gotta get to bed. I gotta get back to work and then to bed. John, thank you as always.
Oh, DJ, so much. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Blast. And hey, honestly, it's just a blast to be able to like this morning text you and just be like, what did you think? And you know, awesome. Thank you so much for everything. Appreciate it.
No, thank you. Right. You take care and I'll speak with you soon.
Sounds good. Everybody else, what do you gotta do?
Go push play.
What he said.
That's right.
Hey, Fred.
This has been a Hey Fred production with theme music by Jeff Bernhardt and Throne Vault Productions.